Do we finally have a blood test that can tell us whether someone will develop Alzheimer's?
The surgical safety checklist actually improves safety.
What about whole genome testing?
And how often and why are randomized studies stopped?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on March 14th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, I'd like to turn first, if you don't mind, to Nature Medicine, this really provocative idea that somehow, some way, we may finally have a handle on who's at risk or who's likely to develop Alzheimer's disease.
Well, this has received widespread press. What the authors represent is they've developed a blood test that's 90% accurate in predicting who may develop Alzheimer's disease. So let's open the hood and kick the tires for a minute, take a look at it. This was a study of 525 community-dwelling individuals that were 70 years or older that were followed for 5 years. And these individuals had cognitive testing done. And what they realized was that there were 74 of these individuals who met the criteria for having mild cognitive impairment or mild Alzheimer's. And there were 28 that developed it over the five-year period. They ran a number of different blood tests. They identified 10 different chemicals that decreased in individuals who subsequently developed mild cognitive impairment over 2 or 3 years. What we need to do is we need to test this in a much larger population, and whether this blood test can predict 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, or just immediately beforehand. But it's hypothesis generating and provocative.
Well, some of the other positive aspects with regard to this test are that it's non-invasive, because right now we really don't have any good way to take a look and see whether there's somebody who is accumulating plaque in their brain. We have to use some pretty serious stuff in order to do that. So that's one thing about it. The other thing about it, to me, is that it seems to hone in on a biochemical abnormality, which may be involved in the actual genesis of the condition. And that's something that I find really interesting, because I don't think we really understand any of that.
You're right. In fact, you'd like to have some plausible biologic mechanism. And what the authors of this study propose is that this is a marker of neural degeneration. These different chemicals are involved in either maintaining the membrane of neurons and or important in energy regulation. And it may pan out, but it's still too early to tell.
We'll keep watching. While we're talking about these sort of investigational things, why don't we turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association? I served it up as, hey, what about this whole genome sequencing anyway?
Is whole genome sequencing ready for prime time is the best way to advertise it. It was an exploratory study of just 12 adults. We looked at the entire genome. What do we do with that information once we get it? And so they took these 12 individuals. They did whole genome sequencing. They used at least two different platforms or two different techniques. And then they presented the data to physicians that are really fairly knowledgeable about this particular topic. And what they realized is, despite our current techniques, is we're still not able to dig down as deeply as we want to identify things in known areas of abnormality in about 10 to 20% of individuals. When you look across different platforms, there's disagreement about whether there's a genetic abnormality or not. And then more importantly, when they looked at the median number of unique variations in the individuals, which was slightly less than 3 million, that's a staggering amount of information. And once they got it, they didn't know what to do with it, because many of these variations have no correlation with the disease process. So what the author said is, gosh, this is a good example of where our capabilities are advancing more rapidly than what we know to do with the information. Right now, if somebody knocks on your door and says, gosh, would you like your whole genome sequenced? The answer is not quite yet.
Good information, of course, so that we can avoid unnecessary testing. On the other hand, I would say that the accumulation of this body of data is going to eventually lead to some creative soul who's going to say, hey, I can figure out how to discern the differences, what their clinical import is. And then I would finally remind everyone that we have this thing that's beyond the genome, the epigenetic changes that are also very important in disease. So that until and unless we get to the point where we're able to integrate those into the whole thing, I don't know if we're ever going to really, in our lifetime anyway, have this really robust clinical picture.
Elizabeth, as you mentioned, it's going to take a centralized repository of getting all this data. It's going to take the ability to determine the biologic consequences. I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Well, gosh, I feel really good about that. Let's stay in the Journal of the American Medical Association then and take a look at this idea that, wow, we begin and accrue a lot of patients into clinical trials, and then, oh no, all of a sudden these clinical trials go away at a significant cost, I would say, in terms of both money and human effort. What in the world happens?
Well, you're right. When we start a randomized clinical trial and we don't finish it, we're essentially wasting what I say are scarce research opportunities and resources. Well, the real question is, how often does that happen? This is a retrospective study of randomized controlled trials in Switzerland, Germany, and Canada. They came back 11 and a half years later and said, how many times was the study never completed? And the answer was a staggering 25%. And then when they dug a little deeper and said, why didn't they ever finish the study? The major issue was they couldn't recruit enough individuals in that study. And that was more likely for investigator versus industry-sponsored studies, and more likely when the study was smaller than it was larger as well. Finally, it should come as no surprise that discontinued trials were more likely to remain unpublished than completed trials.
Gosh, wonder how this compares to data in the United States.
The discontinuation here appears to be about 45%.
So, if you had a fix that you would impose upon this right now, what would you say?
I'd say we need to develop better strategies to prevent this trial discontinuation by doing better pilot studies. We also need to have contingency plans in place if the recruitment's lower than expected.
Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. Something else that seemed like intuitively, as we headed into this whole thing, looked like, well, of course this works really well. What is the real value of surgical checklists to improve patient safety?
Elizabeth, I know this is close to your heart because a lot of this information has originated from Hopkins, and Peter Pronovost has been an important figure in terms of making the hospital and surgery much safer. We have a number of observational studies that suggest that the use of surgical safety checklists results in striking improvements in the surgical outcomes. And as a result, there's been a rapid adoption of these, so that currently there are over 6,000 hospitals that use these safety checklists, but nobody's ever doing a randomized trial to see whether they're effective or not. But in Ontario, there's a unique opportunity because there's been a policy that encouraged the universal adoption of checklists by all hospitals. So it gives us a natural experiment. We can look at the surgical outcome before the safety checklists are incorporated and then 3 months after it. So during the 3 months before and the 3 months after adoption of the surgical checklist, they looked at the results from 101 hospitals that performed over 200,000 procedures. What they determined was that there was no difference in the adjusted risk of death with the institution of surgical checklists. And by the way, the adjusted risk of surgical complications was no different before or after. So, unfortunately, despite what the observational studies suggest, this study shows that the implementation of surgical safety checklists was not associated with a significant reduction in operative mortality or in complications.
How crazy. Certainly not what we would have expected from the rest of the data that's accumulated previous to this analysis. I would also cite Peter Pronovost, though, in saying this. What I'd like to see is, all right, then what were the nature of the errors that occurred both before and after the implementation of these checklists? Because one thing he said to me once was, well, Elizabeth, what happens is once we eliminate one source of errors, it opens the door to another source of errors. And I think that's true almost no matter where we look.
You bring up a very good point. How effective were they in using these surgical checklists? Now, the other possibility, Elizabeth, is the observational studies previously done. If they had a positive result, they published their results. If they had a negative result, they didn't. So there's a possibility that there was publication bias, but this study was really surprising. It goes in the face of what we otherwise thought.
I don't think at the moment, though, that that's going to change behavior in the OR previous to a patient coming into the OR. I think we're still going to see those implementations with regard to things like making sure that the surgical site is correct, making sure that the patient is the right patient, making sure that a procedure is followed for the placement of a central line and so forth. I think those are things that we're still going to see those checklists in place for.
And I agree with you. As you and I know, that accounts for relatively few of the major medical problems. But nevertheless, being able to prevent those is important and is easy to do. But I think what this tells us is that checklists alone may not be the answer. And Peter would tell us that as well. It has to do more with teamwork, more with communication, using it to improve the processes and look on down the line.
So on that up note, I'm going to say that in the blog this week, I will write about the surgical safety. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
Before I sign off, when will the website change?
Ah, yes. I think it's going to be in probably the next 2 weeks.
All right. Just so our listeners are aware, we'll send out plenty of notice, but our listeners will need to update their RSS feed.
Very good. And who are you again?
I'm Rick Lang. You know that, Elizabeth. But y'all live well.